The talk is about things we did on two kind of materials mostly. It involves a large number of collaborations and a large number of people in my group. Eric and Herman in particular, whose data I'll talk about today mostly, and Van Mechelen. But then we have collaborations with various people who make samples in Geneva and Lausanne and Leiden, but also with and Stanford. Also with a number of theoretical groups like Frank Marsiglio, Christian Haule and Kochliar, Lausanne, Ugo Mazen and Claudio Grimaldi. The outline of the talk, so I'll talk first a bit about the optical properties of cuprates, and in particular about the analysis in terms of the alpha square epsilon coupling theory. Then address the issue of mass singularization, both in the cuprates, but also in niobium doped quantum titanate, which is also superconductor. And say a few words about photons versus dressed electrons in quantum titanate. This is the group, or I would say rather, was the group, it's supposed to be evolving, but it's the group about half a year ago, and we had an informal get together for a few days in Sils Maria. So, what makes cuprate special, first of all? From many of you, it is a repetition. Well, first of all, of course, it's pairing symmetry, which is D wave, or not first of all, second of all. First of all, it's very high TC. Of order 100 to 250 Kelvin, depending on which material you have. Secondly, the D-wave pairing symmetry. And then thirdly, the very peculiar and complicated phase diagram where not only superconductivity appears, but also this sort of mysterious pseudo-gap phase. And then in close proximity, the fact that it is an anti-ferromagnet and a Hubbert invariant material if it's not doped. There's on the right-hand side properties akin to a Fermi liquid with an ordinary Fermi surface. I'll say a few introductory words about BCS theory. Why is that? Well, this pseudo-gap phase, of course, has been drawn a lot of attention. You see many things there. In particular, you see some kind of striped order appearing in STM in particular, I've seen, but also many transport properties are indications of it. On the other hand, there are other indications coming from the Nernst effect, but also from low-frequency optical spectra like those by the Orenstein, that somewhere in this range, just above TC at least, the pseudo-gap might be caused by the presence of pair correlations, albeit not a pair condensate, because a condensate implies immediately having superconductivity. So, in that connection, it is interesting to revise what are the paradigms of BCS theory. So the first paradigm is that the normal state in a BCS theory should be a Fermi liquid. And then at sufficiently low temperature, a finite fraction of electrons becomes paired due to the inter-electron attraction. And then the most important thing perhaps in BCS theory is that at the same temperature where pairs begin to form at the superconducting phase transition, they immediately condense into a macroscopic quantum state. And that is, of course, different from other pictures, which one would need to understand the pseudo-gap phase in terms of already existing pair correlations without having a condensate. That's the opposite order of energy scales, where first the pairing energy scale at high energies occurs, and then cooling down farther to lower temperatures, you would get your condensate. In BCS theory, it's either the reverse order. The condensation temperature in the BCS theory is essentially a few thousand Kelvin or even 10,000 Kelvin. And then as soon as pairs form, they have no other option than immediately condensing, or they have no other state to form into as in their condensed state. So these are the three paradigms of BCS theory. Now, the thing that we have been looking at attentively is the following: what happens to the kinetic energy in a superconductor? At least we've tried to address that issue over the years using optical spectroscopy as a technique. The issue was brought on stage by Hirsch, not really by the BCS model, although it's implicit in there. In BCS theory, there is a very simple result by just applying the BCS model equations, and it's quite easy to calculate what happens to the kinetic energy of your charge carriers. If you cool them down, of course, kinetic energy decreases. Nothing abnormal about that. That's happening in any normal metal. And actually gives rise to the linear term in the specific heat at low temperatures. But then, as soon as the condensate forms, and as soon as pairs form, that's the most important thing, when pairs form, the kinetic energy of your electrons is increased because of the fact that in a paired state, you no longer have a sharp Fermi cutoff. It actually becomes a broadened distribution. That means you're forcing the electrons to occupy higher momentum states and higher kinetic energy states. That, of course, is happening because they are paired. In other words, there is some increase in kinetic energy, but there is a larger decrease in pairing potential, which overcomes this increase, and that makes it the superconductivity happening again. Now, Jorge Hirsch had a rather radical point of view. He has a different pairing mechanism, which is non-BCS, which is really a kinetic energy decrease itself. There's a particular term in Hamiltonian, in this case, which corresponds to a kinetic energy term, but for pairs. And that means that as soon as these pairs form, there's actually a decrease of kinetic energy, and he proposed that as a mechanism for all superconductors, not only high-TC superconductors. His model also predicts S-wave pairing, and thereby is in contradiction to what one finds in the cuprates, but at least this aspect he predicted, and is one of the reasons, or the reasons also, why we wanted to check that many years ago. And he actually provided also a method to do so, and that's how we got into this. He actually pointed out that if you look at the integrated optical conductivity of a metal or of a superconductor, sigma of omega, which is highly peaked at low frequencies in the normal state of a superconductor, it becomes gapped in the superconducting state, and then there's also delta function in the superconducting state. If you just take the integral over the delta function plus what remains in this Lorentz form, in this Duda form, and you integrate it up to sufficiently high energies that it includes all intraband portions, then there is a rule which is originally due to Maldak, later extended by Beersville for many body systems. It says that this spectral rate of your conduction band is proportional to minus the kinetic energy in a nearest neighbor tight binding model. If it's not nearest neighbor tight binding, you have a slightly different formula, this formula. If it's nearest neighbor tight binding, you have this formula, which is exactly the kinetic energy. Otherwise, it's very close to a kinetic energy, but it's not exactly the same thing. But in any case, this is what we can measure, and it's of course interesting to prepare and compare that to what is predicted in the various models for the kinetic energy. So we set out doing this in 1999, I think, for the AB plane. There was a prehistory for on the C-axis, which I won't repeat here. And this is here the spectral weight minus the spectral weight, actually normalized such as to give zero at zero temperatures, as a function of temperature squared, as it will sound, which has a T-square variation. And then when you enter into the superconducting state, there is an additional drop. And mind you, this is minus spectral weight, so the sign is chosen such as to represent something which is proportional to the kinetic energy. So you see kinetic energy decreasing, and then it decreases extra in the superconducting state. This here is the calculation. Now, the calculation based on the BCS model now of the spectral weight, the same quantity as measured over here, not the kinetic energy, and you see that it is doing precisely the opposite thing in the superconducting state as what was measured. So the BCS model fails here. Whereas if you if you do calculations of, and I should admit, these are calculations of the kinetic energy and not of the directly measured quantity spectral weight, but in this model, which is the nearest neighbor TJ model, sorry, the nearest neighbor Hubbert model, it would actually correspond to the same thing anyway in this model. It's a Hubbert model calculated using cluster DMFT, quite a long while ago, and actually found precisely the same trend as what we found in the experiment. And remind again, kinetic energy is what they calculate, and it has the same, it's really almost the same thing as the spectral weight as displayed over here. So in the normal state, all models and the experiment agree, but then in the superconducting state, the Hubbert model actually has an extra decrease as it was seen in the experiment. Now, why that happens in the Hubbert model is probably because in the Hubbert model you have a repulsive U over there. So all the usual arguments that one has for a weakly attractive interaction in the BCS model simply don't apply. In fact, since this is a large U, the usual perturbation approaches do not work, and one has to resort to hard numerical techniques like cluster DMFT. Here are a few more examples. This is now not minus spectral bait, but plus spectral bait. Watch out, that's minus kinetic energy. So cooling down, you see it increase now. And you see there's an extra increase. So again, opposite to the BCS model over here. For optimally doped and underdoped. For an overdoped sample, you see no effect at all at TC. And for a strongly overdoped sample, you see it turn down. And that is now similar in direction, and even in size, as to the BCS model predictions. So there is a sign reversal that we found, but not as the first. In fact, the sign reversal had been reported by Deutscher, Sandown there, and Bontal in 2005. It's a confirmation of that effect, that you see a change of sign as a function of doping. And the question, of course, then is what it means. Before I get into that, let me first show you a summary of all our results. I'm not showing the results obtained by other teams here, but there are two other teams in the game, namely Bernard and collaborators, and Bontemps and collaborators. Bernard doesn't give numbers here, but he says that it is opposite to what we mean, to what we measure. And Bontemps has a couple of points, three, which actually follow the same trend from negative spectral wave change to positive. So this is the anti-BCS range, and this is the according to BCS range. And then there's a point where there's no effect at all, as you would expect if you go from one to the other. There's a big effect for the triple layer compound, essentially, one might say, that the effect seen in the spectral wave is roughly proportional also to TC. So it does seem to track the condensation energy of your system in that sense. Now, what does it all mean? Of course, if it would have been always the same sign of the effect, we would have victoriously announced or maintained, I would rather say, that we have a special mechanism which is anti-BCS. In fact, we cannot maintain it because of the sign change. It looks more as if what's going on is something that actually had been pointed out by Norman and Pétain in 2002, who said, well, you see, there is, if you have just one mechanism, one essentially standard pairing mechanism, which is valid everywhere, but there's an intermediate state on the underdoped side, which is already gapped, but for another reason, then what may happen, well, actually does happen in this case, there is already a broadened Fermi distribution in the normal state, that's the red line over here, which can either become narrower, sharper, or even broader in the superconducting state. Apparently, and that's not completely understood, so this the sign or what happens is such that it's actually becoming sharper in the superconducting state than it was in the normal state. So in that sense, it looks like this the normal state is really a competing phase, which is overcome by a more advantageous state at low temperature, which is the superconducting state. Another possible interpretation would be that actually you really do have sort of a preformed pair phase over here, which has not yet condensed. And then it condenses, and when it condenses, you actually do gain, like in any model of Bose condensation of pairs, you do gain kinetic energy, and that would correspond to the same sign as what we see. And then, of course, in the on the Fermi liquid side, it's precisely the opposite. If you compare at t equals zero, the normal state, and the superconducting state, at t equals zero, there would be a sharp Fermi cutoff, which then becomes broader in the superconducting state, and that would explain why we see the opposite sign of the effect when we compare the normal state and the superconducting state. So that would mean that actually we have a pretty conventional picture. The only non-conventional part of it is that we have a pairing mechanism which is capable to give a very high TC everywhere, but it simply is not allowed to get to this very high TC over here because it's intercepted by another phase, by some other phenomenon. Well, if that's true, then we feel more comfortable about doing something that we could have done 10 years ago, but always put aside as being totally irrelevant to the coup rates. And that is to ask ourselves, is there a glue? And if so, what is the relevant energy scale of this glue? Would it be phonons, or bioresonance, or multiphonon, or N-magnon, multimagnon, or some plasmon energy, or charge transfer energy, or Hubbard U, any of these things? And of course, in relation to that, if we do find, for example, electron-phonon coupling to be important in the story, is it good or is it actually bad for superconductivity in these materials? The way to go about in optical spectroscopy, that's a very old story, it really goes back to Phil Allen already in the 60s and 70s, then refined later on by Maksimov and Marsiglio and Cabot in later years, says, okay, the optical conductivity is in principle just given by the Kubov formula, over here. It has Fermi factors in it, it has self energies in it, and the self energies are just given by the fact that the electrons have these very simple diagrams, you know, a line and a little bigly line connected to it, where temporarily you create your electron picks up or emits a phonon or another boson. And in that expression, what appears are not besides the alpha square F function, also you have the boson and the Fermi occupation pairs. These formulas over here. I realize now that this should have been used to different notations in this formula. That's the Fermi factor over here. So you can use the recipe. I'm going to use this recipe later on. But let me first say a few words about how we go about experimentally now. So what we really measure in the end is sigma 1 and sigma 2. Sigma 1 is the dissipative part of the optical conductivity, and sigma 2, that's the dispersive part of the optical conductivity. We have both pieces of information very precisely because we use a combination of reflectivity and ellipsometry. Ellipsometry provides directly sigma 1 and sigma 2. In our case, we use ellipsometry at somewhat higher frequencies than where these data are shown. And where the data here are shown, we actually use ordinary reflectivity spectroscopy. But having the ellipsometry in a very broad range of frequencies and for all temperatures where curves are shown helps us to get a very precise upper bound on the Kramers-Kronig relations needed to obtain sigma 1 and sigma 2 from reflectivity data. So these are very precise dissipation and dispersion curves measured experimentally. Now, if you look at such a curve, the optical conductivity of the conduction electrons is given by the Drudov formula. Maybe I should have put that on the blackboard. There won't be. Let me put it here because you're a minority. Put it here. Where this 1 over tau is visible for you. Yeah. So you can actually replace the 1 over tau by the imaginary part of a self energy, but of course if you only have an imaginary part of self energy, if it depends on frequency, there should also be a real part of the self energy. So this can actually be generalized by just replacing it by replacing this entire thing. Now it's no longer visible for you. I omega plus sigma of omega. And that's the optical sigma. So it has a real and imaginary part. If that's true, you can just invert this our equation. The only thing you need to know is the plasma frequency. So you just take the optically measured sigma 1 plus I sigma 2. Take 1 over that quantity, multiply with the plasma frequency here, subtract the frequency itself, and you get the real and imaginary part of this optical self energy, where the imaginary part would be your scattering rate if it would be frequency independent. So here's an example of that. This is now the real part, the optical self energy. Actually rises linearly, goes to a maximum in a normal state, and then trails off, and actually trails off. The exfoliation at high frequencies will go to zero in the end, although we don't measure that far. There's a very distinct and clear maximum over here. In the superconducting state, there's another maximum, but here you have to be a little bit more careful about this maximum, because in the superconducting state, there's also a gap. And of course, if the optical spectrum is gapped, you can no longer apply the simple Dudek formula that we wrote on the blackboard over here. And you can no longer use the simple inversion. You have to take into account the structure, more complicated structure of a gapped optical conductivity. So if you forget that for the moment, at all temperatures, there is, at 300 Kelvin, down to 20 Kelvin, there's this maximum at around 0.3 electron volt. That's a very high energy scale. And a thing that was pointed out by Norman and Chubukov, 2006, I think, and that was pointed out before the everybody started to talk about the waterfall effect in ARTES in coupes. They pointed out that if you have such a maximum here, it tells you that the upper limit of your glue function of alpha squared is around 0.3, 0.25 eV. And they assumed their own Mont model that they like a lot, of which is essentially the Millis-Monin-Pines model, which indeed gives a reasonably good fit to this optical self-energy. Now, what we did then was to use numerical fitting to our optical spectra, just to the reflectivities and the optical ellipsometry data at high frequencies, using numerical fitting. So there's not without human in, human involvement, so to speak. You just set your model, and then you let the computer fit to try to find the best alpha square f, so the best fitting alpha square f function. Here's one example of such a model. If you do such fitting, it turns out that the number of parameters which you can fit is very small, and that's because the formula which I showed you for alpha square f as it corresponds to optical conductivity is very indirect. It's really so that you would need incredibly precise optical data to get more detail than I'm showing in this graph over here. So the model that we fitted over here for alpha square f was one where we had just two peaks. So you allowed to be there two peaks in which the width, the intensity, and the position could be fitted, altogether six parameters. And what one obtains is for all temperatures in the normal state, again, it's all for the normal state, indeed, two peaks, one at 15 millielectron volt, and the other one, quite robustly, at a quarter of an electron volt, with almost temperature-independent intensities. The raw data is shown as points over here, and the fits through the data are shown as fits, and, well, okay, so they are good. However, it's a tricky business. In fact, we started this really being motivated by Chandra Varma to look at his margin firm liquid model and try to get a fit. And again, if you make a fit and you look at just the reflectivity fitted to the margin firm liquid model, you would also say it looks very good. So it is actually very important to quantify how good it precisely is and also how robust it is. And so we did that. So we made a sort of a what is my best model quiz, where we tested the margin Fermi liquid model, giving a good fit, but with a chi-square. That's the quality of the fit. So it's the inverse quality of the fit, which is about 117 to 160 for three different temperatures in the normal state. But then if you test the robustness of it, and you add one additional oscillator, it turns out that your fit becomes almost 10 times as good by adding just one additional oscillator. And in fact, the fit always tries to put this oscillator at an energy of 50 millielectron volt. That's a typical phonon energy. If you do the two oscillator fitting, you get almost the same fit quality at room temperature. It gets actually a little better still than the margin Fermi liquid plus oscillators at 100 Kelvin. This is the Millis-Monin-Pines model. Gives reasonably good fit, much better than marginal Fermi liquid. But again, it's not completely robust. If you add one oscillator to it, and again, it turns out to be 50 millielectron volt in all the fits, you get a much better fit quality. Then, to test how important it is that we have really narrow peaks for our fit, instead of taking narrow peaks, we just took blocks, the square blocks. You get almost the same quality as with oscillators, where the number of blocks is the same as the number of oscillators. So you have just two blocks, essentially, you have to fit to the spectrum. Then we have three blocks, where you have for a few more extra parameters for the blocks, and you get better fit. So the winners of this quiz are either the two oscillators or the free blocks, and I'll show you what it looks like in a minute. So this is this marginal Fermi liquid shown for three different temperatures. What it tries to do, what your fit tries to do, is to get some maximum at some intermediate frequency at around 100-150 millielectron volt over here for all temperatures. If you do the Mendes-Morin-Pines model, that model has built in the possibility to create a peak at 50 millielectron volt, and actually it does that also. It really wants to put a peak over there. If you do our block model, and I already showed you the two oscillator model, it's almost the same as the block model. So if you do this number of blocks, it tries to put blocks in such a way as to have a relatively narrow peak at 50 millielectron volt and another much broader peak at a quarter of an electron volt. So that's just what's coming out of the least square fitting, where this one obviously is the winner. That is the one that fits best. Interesting, by the way, is that even in this model, there is a crucial, I think, an important and significant temperature dependence at the low frequency side of this block. And the reason to emphasize that is that this frequency dependence is an inherent property of the marginal Fermi liquid model. So even though the details of the marginal Fermi liquid are quite different from this block model, one of the points very important for the original philosophy behind it is preserved. And that point was that the relevant energy scale in your boson spectrum is given by the temperature itself. And that's actually revealed by this temperature dependence over here. One might say that this is necessary to preserve at low frequencies, or maybe at zero frequency, I should say, this linear temperature dependence of the resistivity. It's an important point. If you try to fit a linear temperature dependence over resistivity, there's an alpha square F model. The only temperature independent model which does it would be a delta function, alpha square F delta function, at zero temperature. However, if you then also try to fit the optical data, that does not produce a good fit. So producing the optical data, you apparently need to put two oscillators at 50 millielectron volt and a quarter of an electron volt. And then the fitting routine uses another possibility to still maintain this linear temperature dependence of the resistivity, and that's by making alpha square F itself temperature dependent. Now, of course, having a temperature dependent alpha square F is essentially the same thing as saying that one of the ingredients in your Hamiltonian is temperature dependent. In principle, alpha square F should not be temperature dependent, and all the temperature dependence actually would enter into this Kuba formula through the Fermi and the Bose occupation numbers. But those are not sufficient. You still need to put in the temperature dependence in alpha square F, and that is something to worry about a bit. That maybe calls into question whether we are on the right track here. I'm not sure about it. This is for a few other compounds. This is now the previous one was mercury 1201. We did it also on bismuth 2223. This is bismuth 2212 for three different dopings. And I compare it to a publication by Timmers, Schachinger and Carbot, who used maximum entropy fitting. Maximum entropy, yeah, it's fitting. They also went down to lower temperatures below TC, which we didn't do because we hadn't really evolved the... we haven't really worked out very well how to do the supergravitation gap. It's quite complicated, actually, to do that correctly. And not only complicated, you have to make a couple of model choices, which I don't like to commit myself too much to. Model choices having to do with how to take into account the dependence around the Fermi surface of your gap and the associated scattering rates. So once you actually compare the red, black and green curves that we got with our block model, is those that were obtained by Schachinger and company. And there you see, grosso modo, the same features. There is a maximum, roughly, or there's an alpha square F function which extends up to 0.3, 0.4 electron volt in this case, in both cases, in both fits. And there is an additional, somewhat higher density of states in alpha square F at low frequencies, which what we find is quite broad, really. And they find a narrower peak because, well, we use a different, sorry, because I'm wrong here. They find a narrower peak, but it looks even more narrow because they also go to low temperature. If you just look at 100 Kelvin, for example, it's still a bit narrower, but not much narrower. In any case, these two features structure you find back in our data as well as in Timask's data, so that seems to be confirmed. Of course, an important aspect of all this would be to see what would be the corresponding lambda, what would be the corresponding parameter responsible for superconducting pairing. There are two ways of doing this, as a matter of fact. One of them consists of integrating out the alpha square f function divided by the frequency itself, and then at high frequency, where it ends, that gives us the value of lambda. So for the mercury 1201, which is a TC of 97 Kelvin, we find a lambda which depends on temperature. Already pointed out this temperature dependence, which is maybe a little fishy, but on the order of 2. If you do the same analysis, if you do a different kind of analysis, we actually analyze the optical, the self-energy function. This is not the optical self-energy now, this is the self-energy. It is the optical self-energy. So optical self-energy divided by the frequency in the limit for frequency going to zero, we also find something between 2 and 2.5 here. So that confirms what we found. The two ways of analyzing gave essentially the same result. It's a mass synchronization, it's a lambda of order 2 in this particular compound. If you do it for bismuth 2 to 1,2, we also get 2. If you do it for bismuth 2 to 2,3, with a much higher TC, you get a much higher value of 2.8. So it seems to track also TC in this case. Another compound where we did the same analysis is zirconium dodecaboride, with a TC of 6 Kelvin. And there you find a lambda, which is a little bit over 1. There's a somewhat bigger error bar in this case, which is significantly below what you get in the cuprates, where it goes to 2 to 2.5. So I just show it because the cuprates are not the only compound. And in fact, the cuprates are maybe the compound where one may question the correctness of this analysis. In the dodecaborides, it's less contested, more considered as a conventional superconductor, where this is probably definitely an appropriate analysis. So the second part of my talk will not be about cuprates, but about niobium strontium titanate. It's a very old and long story. It started in the 70s already by in particular by Betnort by Müller, but also Betnort was involved in the beginning, and Baratov and Binning were involved. Many people at IBM essentially were highly interested in niobium doped strontium titanate, another kind of doping of this compound. And this is just a sentence out of the Nobel lecture of Betnort and Müller, who explain how this strontium titanate research led them to high TC superconductors. We went back to the system for another reason. The reason is that in the previous example of the high TC superconductors, the alpha square F, that one fits, is very difficult to interpret. It's clear that a 50 millisecond volt peak could be a phonon or represent several phonons. But a quarter of an electron volt peak is very difficult to reconcile with phonons, unless it would be multiphonon. But there are many other possibilities. It could also be coupling to spin fluctuations, which is a very reasonable option, also borne out by strong coupling calculations by Jarol and Meyer, and Scalfino is involved. So it's a reasonable option. But there are many other competitors. There is this these flux current modes of pharma that might do the job. It could be excitons, could be plasmons. There's just too many candidates. Strontium titanate is a perovskite material. It is related structure-wise and also electronically somewhat to the cuprates and to also the strontium ruthenate and to manganite. So it's really interesting because of that. And may give us some indication about what the electron-phonon coupling strength typically is in this class of materials. And that's why we went back to this problem. Because these are low-doped materials, And there's really nothing else around than just the electron-phonon coupling that could explain our data. There's no problem here of multiple interpretation. It's also a superconductor, but a very low TC superconductor. There's a TC of maximum 0.4. There are a few reports, in fact, in the previous slide already showed you, that Ben Rosenmuller claim a point at 1.2 Kelvin, but there's sort of a lonely point up there that nobody understands. In fact, there's quite a bit of scatter in these TCs also, and that's really outside error bars, so there's definitely something not quite understood about what really the relation is between TC and the doping of these materials. It is a two-band, or actually multi-band superconductor, and pretty early on again, in this work by Binnach, Baritov, Hoenig, and Betnortz, it was found using tunneling spectroscopy to be a two-gap superconductor. So they found two gaps in two different bands. And in fact they studied the doping dependence of these two different gaps. Very recently a lot of interest came back into this material, because it turns out that if you make a super lattice or multi-layer out of lanthanum aluminate and strontium titanate without any doping at all, the interface does become superconducting by sort of an auto-doping system. It's a charge composition effect by which you form a conducting layer at the interface, most likely, but not completely proven to be the case, but most likely on the side of the strontium titanate, where you find a TC of about 0.2 Kelvin. So it's about the same TC as found in bulk strontium titanate. It was worked on by a collaboration of Mannhardt and Triskonen's group at the University of Geneva. But they could also establish that they are really two-dimensional layers. The thickness of the layer is just a few angstrom, so it's really two-dimensional. Also, it has all the properties of a Costerly-Paulus phase transition. If you study in magnetic fields the phase transition of this material. So it's truly two-dimensional. If you look, go back now to the convection bands of the pure bulk strontium titanate, of course it's a semiconductor, so it has a gap of about the band calculation, the most recent one using Wien code done by Masin, which predicts 2 electron volt. The measured value of the gap is much bigger, it's almost 3 electron volt. If you dope by substituting niobium on the titanium sides, you move the Fermi energy into these unoccupied bands over here, of which there are 3, which are somewhat split, but slightly split only, by 2 factors, a spin orbit effect and a very small crystal field splitting due to a small distortion of the lattice at low temperature, below 100 Kelvin. So there's 3 bands. There's a very strange dispersion of the bands, actually. It's the strange dispersion has to do with the fact that these are T to G bands. So the bands are an XY band, an YZ, and an XZ band. And it's, in principle, these could give rise to complete two-dimensional dispersion. It's just that if you have a cubic lattice and you look at an XY or a DXY orbital, then a DXY orbital couples very well to other DXY orbitals on atoms which are in the same plane, but not at all, or very much weaker in any case, to atoms which are in adjacent planes. So that's actually borne out by this structure here. The fact you see a small dispersion in this direction is due to the fact this dispersion actually reflects the coupling from an XY in one plane to one which is parallel to it. And that's the same for all 3 bands. The Fermi energy by doping, so we dope up to about 2% charge carriers into here, 2% per titanium atom, that lifts the Fermi energy, according to the band calculation, about 0.1 electron volt inside the unoccupied bands. That's an important point also. 0.1 electron volt is a low energy. It's an energy which is about the same as the phonon energy to which you couple. So the highest doping we have corresponds to a Fermi energy which is just equal to the most important phonon to which you couple. It's the opposite as the conventional situation in the Born-Oppenheimer limit, where the Fermi energy could be 10 electron volt and is much bigger. So it means that electrons are quite slow as compared to the vibrational motion of the phonons, so you are in the anti-adiabatic limit, as it is called.
Which in strontium titanate, the system is very close to being a ferroelectric, right?
Yeah, so I didn't show that. Yeah. Is that important or not? Well, it was one of the motivating factors for us. Later we found out by studying carefully the Frölich model that there's a soft phonon. I'll show in a few graphs very soon which one it is. In fact, this soft phonon is not terribly important for electron-phonon coupling. The amount of coupling that provides is small in the Frölich model. It may be important for other reasons, but not Frölich. So these are resistivity and Hall effect measured on this compound. There's a weak temperature dependence of the Hall effect, which is so if you take one of the Hall constant, which corresponds to the doping concentration, you find the same doping concentration as predicted by the nominal concentration of niobium doped in the system. Already a little bit strange, actually, I must say. It puts some constraints on the amount of anisotropy that you can have in miles and in scattering rate in the bands, because this is a multi-band situation. But in any case, it's just almost right on top of this nominal doping concentration, and it decreases a little bit as you go to higher temperatures. There's a T-square DC resistivity. There's pretty rather precise T-square power law behavior over here. Of course, that's also amazing. I mean, this is an electron-phonon coupled system, and you would certainly not expect it to come out T-square, it would have to be T to the third. But you find T-square, and that's robust. It's slightly different from ideal T-square, but actually becomes better if you take the scattering rate instead of the resistivity after correcting for a measured temperature dependence of the N over M ratio using optics. What we measure are diffusivity spectra. I'm sorry for dumping a lot of detail on you here, but it is relevant. These are reflectivity spectra in the infrared at two different temperatures. What you see are a number of dips. So let's concentrate on the black curve first. That's the undoped mother compound, strontium titanate. All the peaks and dips here are phonons. And this little kink at about 12 millielectron volt, that is the soft phonon which you had in mind. So if you cool it down, this soft phonon moves to the left and actually shifts outside of our spectral range, which stops here at about 3 millielectron volts, actually goes left of that. It doesn't go all the way down to zero, but it's getting close. About 1 millielectron volt is the lowest energy it gets to. And that gives you a huge value of the dielectric static constant, that low DC static dielectric constant, about 10,000. So it's enormous. If you dope it, it doesn't change so much the phonon frequencies at 300 Kelvin, but there's a bit of a rise, especially for the 2%. You very clearly see that there's an additional rise here, and that's because there is now also a free carrier contribution, due to which the reflectivity should really go to 100% ultimately. Although, again, that happens outside the range of this section. If you go to 7 Kelvin, you see all the same features, but there is now a 100% line everywhere over here. There's a few exceptions. You see these little dips over here. The 100% line is there mostly because for the indoped case, you have a phonon which is still sitting over there. Below this phonon, reflectivity actually should go down again. But for the 1% and 2% doped samples, you clearly see that there's a dip, which is really this phonon, but this has been blue shifted by the substitution of niobium on the titanium side. So niobium blue shifts the phonon frequencies of the soft phonon. It makes it less soft and actually moves it away from this almost ferroelectrical state. The fact that it moves up again, the reflectivity, is due to the free carriers, and that's the crucial piece of information and experimental information that we take advantage of in order to determine the effective mass of the charge carriers. So if you blow that up a little bit, you see better. There's actually a dip and then a rise, a dip and a rise for the two highest dopings. A little bit of a, in fact, this is just noise, but it's going down and then up a little lower for the 0.2% doped sample. And for the undoped sample, we don't see the phonon and the rise, but we're very close to the phonon, but there's a sharper dip further down. There's no doping in that compound. The additional piece of information comes from transmission spectra measured on 10 micron thick slices of samples in the visible and near-infrared range. There's an important structure over here that we use to get precise data on the optical conductivity in the which later turns out to be polarons, and you see a big drop of transmission at around 3.4 electron volt, and that's actually the onset of the interband transitions predicted to be 2 electron volt in the band calculation. So there's a big discrepancy also in the size of the gap, is often the case in LDA calculations. There's no difference over here. There's a nice little dip over there, and if you ask me about it, I'll tell you about it. In order to get very reliable data on the Drude peak, we have to measure at very low frequencies, and for that we use time domain subterahertz transmission. Again, very thin slices of samples. And if you measure the transmission, so there's an N missing, transmission of a undoped slice, it's a planned parallel plate, you find a series of maxima, which are actually just interferences inside your sample. These are so-called Fabry-Pérot resonances. And again, we take advantage of having measured these resonances. They're very useful additional information, which we can easily model because the Fresnel equations are known, in order to extract epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 from our data. If you dope it, you keep the resonance, but of course they get damped, and they get damped simply because you have charged carriers in the system. Also, the transmission becomes lower, and that is really due to the presence of a Drude peak in your sample. What's quite beautiful is if you look at the phase, and there are many theoreticians here, maybe you're all theoreticians, you also know the theorem that if you go through a resonance that the phase should jump by pi. And that's really what you find. Every time you pass through these Fabry-Pérot resonances, the phase steps up by pi, Levinson's theorem. It becomes broadened a little bit as a result of the doping, but it's clearly there. So these are directly measured quantities. You can do that if you have time domain spectroscopy, because you really measure just a electrical field as a function of time, which you can then, after Fourier transform, relate to intensity and phase of your signal. Having these two pieces of information, we can feed that into the Fresnel formula for the transmission. This is the Fresnel formula for the complex transmittivity of a planned parallel plate involving the complex epsilon dielectric constant. There's a real imaginary part, which is a very complicated formula. Well, not very complicated, but it is a formula which is somewhat hard to invert. And again, if somebody would find for me an analytical inversion of this formula, I would be very happy. We did the inversion numerically, very directly, a 20-line, not even a 10-line, little Fortran routine that allows us to iteratively invert the formula in order to get from our transmission and phase vector, or this T over here, to get epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And that's an example of it. This is epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 for two different temperatures. Epsilon 1 here and epsilon 2, in this case represented as sigma 1, it's the same as epsilon 2, 4 pi sigma over omega is epsilon, is epsilon 2. For two different temperatures, the ranges of the data are temperature dependent, and the reason for that is that cooling down your sample, it becomes less transparent because you get a more pileup of free carrier spectral weighted low frequencies that actually shifts the visible spectral range for our experiments. I think I'm wrong, it's extending to lower frequencies. Well, anyways. Oh, this has more to do with the phone, I'm sorry. Okay, so you get a bit of a spectrum, but only this part. For all the rest, you have to rely on either a DC resistivity, which is still lower frequencies, or reflectivity and transmission spectra at higher frequencies. You can feed all that in an overall routine that sigma, epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, and the real part of sigma for all frequencies, and that's what you get. So that is now the optical conductivity for two different temperatures for all frequencies measured. There's a series of peaks with our phonons. There's a background which is due to free carriers at 300 Kelvin. This background becomes much narrower at low temperatures. Remember that the resistivity went down precipitously at low temperatures. That actually means that the width of this free carrier peak also becomes about 100 times or even more as narrow as it was at 300 Kelvin. So actually there's a Drude peak sitting down very low frequency. This gray line is due to the Drude peak. We'll expand it later on. And then the rest is phonons. All of this stuff here is phonons. Optical phonons. So this is...
Phonons are Yankel and Mohs, or?
No, just phonons. Just optical phonons. Yeah. Now, blowing up the low frequency and the spectrum below this lowest frequency mode, the lowest frequency phonon, this is the soft phonon now that we spoke about before. Below the soft phonon, you have this very sharp peak. That's again our directly measured terahertz data over here. And then the dotted lines over here are not directly measured but fitted to the reflectivity data and DC conductivity data. And blowing up this part over here, you see for four different dopings, so it's not indicated over here, but the gray curve is 2% doping, that's 1% doping, 0.2% doping, and 0.1% doping. That's the Drude peak due to the free carriers. And that's what interests us a lot, because the free carrier spectral weight, that's the integrated conductivity of this peak only, subtracting out the phonons, corresponds to the plasma frequency squared divided by 8. So that's universal constant times the density of charge carriers divided by their effective mass, the renormalized mass of the quasi particles. So that's really the response of those quasi particles to an external field, the electrical field. Now, since we already know this n from the Hall effect and also from the nominal doping of the compound, we learn about it what the effective mass is. These are three rules that we apply. If you integrate all frequencies with everything, interband transitions and intraband transitions and satellites and everything, you just get pi e squared over 2 times n over the free electron mass. If you take only the Drude peak, you get n over m star, which is the effective mass. If you take Drude plus satellites stuff that is connected to the Drude, it would actually be n divided by the band mass. Of course, this is a tricky thing, but I'll show you how it works. First of all, the result for just the Drude spectral weight. These are the four red points over here. That's the plasma frequency squared corresponding to this Drude spectral weight. It's a linear doping event, it's not surprising. But if you compare it to what the band theory actually tells us, it is 2.5 times smaller than the band prediction. So it means that there is a renormalization here. It's not enormous, but it is a factor 2.5. If you now look at somewhat higher frequencies above these phonons that I spoke above, so the previous part referred to what's below the phonons, now look at above these phonons. In fact, you see above the phonons an enormous amount of spectral weight, which has a strong doping dependence and a strong temperature dependence also. And the question, what is that? Well, what I like to say here is that, our interpretation is these are satellites. It's there because your electrons are coupled to stuff. And the only stuff present in strontium titanate that could be relevant is phonons, because it's not ferromagnetic, it's not a MOT insulating state. There's only one thing, phonons. Now, it turns out that this form is quite close to predictions in a polaron model of de Vreese. That's point one.
When you say phonons, there is an oxygen cage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are normal modes for this oxygen cage. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not talking about these normal modes. When you talk about phonons.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, just a lattice vibration, any kind of lattice vibration. Yeah. Yeah. But not necessarily those modes. It could be other modes also. But I would guess that it's true that
optical phonons, right?
Yeah, or Raman phonons, but high frequency phonons. Now these are not phonons, they are satellites. The frequency of this is much higher than the phonon frequency itself. So what it really corresponds to is if you go into the chemical literature or physical chemical literature on eigenstates of molecules, if you make an electronic excitation on a molecule, you also bring the system out of its ground state, out of its vibrational ground state, because you change somehow the electronic bond between the atoms forming the molecule. And as a result, you will see not only the energy of the electronic transition, but actually on top of that, you will see an entire series of multi-phonon excitations. not only that, most of the intensity that you see will be inside these multiphonon excitations and not in the direct interband transition itself. The same physics applies to making a transition inside an electron transition within the same band, where you just move an electron from one atom to its neighboring atom. If you move it to its neighboring atom, what happens? Well, on its original position, it was surrounded by a vibrational, mechanical deformation of the lattice. If you move it suddenly to another site, adjacent site, by applying an electrical field, it has to carry along with it this vibrational deformation. So if you just suddenly move it from one place to the other, on the new site, in the new state, it will actually be there, but still the deformation on the site where it came from, and compared to that, so that state that you create by suddenly moving an electron really has a quantum mechanical overlap with highly excited states in the new situation where you've moved your electron to. And these highly excited states are highly excited fibronic states, so multiphonon excited states. And that is actually what all this stuff corresponds to. These are 2, 3, 4 phonon excitations on top of just moving your electron from one side to its neighboring side. So electronically, it's a zero energy mode, but dressed by phonons. And that's what I mean by saying these are satellites of your Drude peak. They're not just phonons. And because it's multiphonon, they're not sharp lines, because you have so many different phonons which have their own enormous dispersion as a function of k. And of course, making a multiphonon cloud makes a very broad distribution. There's a bit of structure in there, which of course then needs to analyze. That's further borne out by looking at the temperature dependence of the two components that I spoke about. There's the Drude part, which has this mass renormalization of about 2.5. If you warm up, you lose intensity in this Drude peak. But the mid-infrared peak, which accidentally has the same intensity if you are measuring it at lowest temperature, increases. So the spectral wave really goes from the Drude peak to the mid-infrared peak. By the way, this temperature dependence of the Drude peak is actually opposite to what typical Polaron models say. And there's a typical Polaron model, and I mean models that that talk about just one Polaron in the system. I think that's my belief about that this is different, simply because we have not one Polaron, we have actually a liquid of Polarons here, a pretty high density of Polarons. Not so high that we are back to a normal metallic state. It's really at a crossover regime, but it's a liquid of polarons. And I guess that what's happening here is warming up. You go from a liquid of polarons, a Fermi liquid of polarons, to a state which is more like a Boltzmann gas of polarons at higher energy. And that would somehow, I don't know how precisely, but that somehow would affect your Drude peak. And also make them more polaron-like, actually. You see, the satellite is becoming more important. So there's a sort of a localization transition by warming up your polarons. They become more polaronic because you move them, you force them to move out of their polaron liquid state.
Is there small polarons?
No, I'll come to that also. Just 2 minutes, almost there.
Why do you want to have lots of polarons?
Well, it's 2% of charge carriers. Each of them is a polaron. The density is high enough to give you a Fermi energy without taking into account okay. So if you for a moment forget about the renormalization, Fermi energy at the highest doping is 0.1 electron volt. Including the mass renormalization, that would become half of that approximately. So that is a high density. I mean, the one polaron model certainly does not apply to that. Now, there's another method to find mass renormalization. That's from specific heat. These are the red points over here. Actually, the specific heat gives a mass renormalization which is much bigger. That's about 4 or 5. Down here, that's you get, compared to the free electron models, about 2 for following from the optics. Again, there are probably good reasons for it. I would say the specific heat is most sensitive to the highest density of states contributions. So it's actually probing the slowest electrons in your system, or those parts of the dispersion which is flattest. whereas the optical spectroscopy is precisely the opposite. The highest intensity in your Drude peak, the highest contributions, come from the lightest electrons or the lightest quasi particles in the system. So this actually gives you sort of a range of values of effective masses around the Fermi surface that one has, upper and lower limit. This here summarizes what I just said. If you look at these experimental data, the mass linearization is anywhere between 2 and 6, depending on how you look at it. This plot here is the mass linearization as a function of the coupling parameter alpha, which is not quite, it's a little bit like lambda, it's not really the same parameters, defined slightly differently in the one polaron model as it was defined by Landau and then later extended by Feynman. So these are the numerical calculations based on Feynman's model. These are the black points. And using those black points, you see that your coupling parameter is in this range, between 2 and 6, depending, you know, which limit of the data you believe most. Probably you should take someone like the average over here. But all of these values are still on the weak coupling side of the phase diagram. And that's why I say these are not small polarons. They are intermediate polarons. So you see, the outcome of this story is somewhat disappointing for everybody. Those people who like to see small polarons are disappointed because they're not small. And those who like to see no polarons at all are also disappointed because there are polarons after all. So it means that that life is not as simple as the cartoons that we like to believe in. Okay, so that concludes almost my story now. For the cuprates with TCs between 80 and 100 Kelvin, we find factors of 2 to 3 mass enhancement. And if a glue model applies, the relevant energy scales appear to be 50 and 250 millielectron volts. So the title of this story was Optics Clues to Pairing Glues. One could rephrase it slightly differently. Optics Clues to the TWU, two pairing glues, one at 50 and one at 250 millielectron volt. If you believe those values and corresponding coupling parameters, TC could be as much as 450 Kelvin if all this electron-phonon coupling or electron-boson coupling could be funneled into a pairing mechanism, which is probably not the case, certainly not for D-wave. Possible candidates are phonons, the pi resonance, but also n-phonon and n-magnon are both of them actually candidates for the 250 millielectron volt feature. However, the glue appears to be strongly temperature dependent, at least at low temperatures, and that's something that one needs to explain as well. And that might be pretty hard to explain with just a electron-phonon coupling model. So that actually is maybe a strong indication that it is not phonons in the end, but it is really some electronic transition. Some electronic mechanism. The strontium titanate has a moderate factor 4 plus or minus 2 mass enhancement. That means the alpha is anywhere between 3 and 5 or so. So they're polarons. If they're polarons, then they're relatively large. They're not small. There's no significant doping dependence of the effective mass. There's a strong doping dependent mid-infrared conductivity. And therefore, I think that the mid-infrared bands are, as they are called, Holstein bands. They are the features that are typically regarded as being typical for polarons. So we see polaron-like features in it, but it doesn't behave like standard polarons. That may be because we are at the crossover between the polaronic limit and Michaelis-Jasberg theory for strontium titanate. Also, if you believe these values of the mass enhancement just from the optical data alone, then they are somewhat on the small side, actually, and would probably not. Now, if you carry that over to the cuprates, assuming that it would have the same value, that would be not sufficient to explain the large values of lambda that we get. But maybe one... but it doesn't look like something one can easily and altogether ignore either. Anyway, that's all I have to say.
I'd like to ask about the current status of theoretical understanding of this fluid.
Is it possible to produce such kind of experimental data by using the crust dynamic analysis?
Yeah, I could have mentioned that actually the
independence is also included.
Yeah, so Hoffmeier and Howler had a paper showing precisely this effect. Yeah, about a year ago. And the well, of course, that's a numerical result. Their interpretation of it is that on the overdocked side, your system starts to behave like electrons coupled to spin perturbations. And that is a BCS-like, or that could be interpreted in a decoupling BCS scheme, using J as your expansion parameter.
All right, well, if there are no other questions, let's thank everybody.